As this conference takes place for the fifth time, I must congratulate the efforts of the organizers on their selection of a theme which is at once positive, proactive, and cautionary. This conference gathers together some of the world's finest thinkers, speakers, and scholars to reflect on the important challenge of securing the future and to share ideas about practical strategies for doing so. For the phrase securing the future reminds us that the future is indisputably not yet secure. The world is beset with many crises: global warming and pollution pose a very real and imminent threat to the planet, not only to plant and animal life, but ultimately to human existence itself. Poverty and financial instability continue to devastate the lives of many people the world over, with more than 780 million individuals globally subsisting on less than $1.90 a day. Almost every day in the news, we hear of discord between nations and peoples, such that, according to data collected by the World Economic Forum, someone is displaced every 3 seconds, driven from their home because of war or persecution. As of the end of 2016, the number of people displaced by conflict worldwide was greater than the population of the entire United Kingdom. Indeed, from all these perspectives, the future seems far from secure. I am especially heartened to know that through its many excellent sub-themes, this conference sets out to address a variety of serious global challenges for the future in discursive and proactive ways. I want to touch upon a number of these topics this morning, and I am delighted that we can also look forward to papers by eminent researchers from a wide variety of countries, fields, and academic institutions, which will explore these themes in greater detail and depth. Although I have opened on a serious note, I come here today with a message of hope and positivity, a call for action. I come here to tell you, to urge you to believe that the future is ours. The future is ours to safeguard and shape, and ours, I hope, to enjoy. The future is ours. It is a short, seemingly simple assertion, and yet one which invites a number of questions. Not least, what do I mean by ours? To whom am I suggesting does the future belong? As a Muslim, I say that the future is ours in that I believe Islam has much to offer when it comes to tackling some of the biggest challenges of the future, particularly in economic and environmental forms. I have spoken in the past about the ways in which Islamic finance, for example, could play a vital role in addressing issues of poverty and financial instability on a larger global scale. It is widely acknowledged that Islamic banks generally fared much better during the financial crisis of 2008, demonstrating greater resilience than non-Islamic banks, according to a report by the International Monetary Fund. This surely is a sign that Islamic finance models could contribute greatly to the global banking sector as a whole, providing stability and security in the face of future economic uncertainty. As well as offering the hope of future economic stability, Islamic finance may also hold some of the answers when it comes to addressing the serious problem of widespread poverty. Through the social finance institutions of zakat, wakaf, and sadaqah, Islam enshrines charitable giving at its core. And there is no doubt that these mechanisms could be better mobilized to provide poor relief to a greater number of individuals, both Muslims and non-Muslims worldwide. We should also note, however, or moreover, the huge potential of sukuk bonds to generate wealth for the common good and for all people. Although sukuk are Sharia-compliant investments, a number of socially responsible investment, or SRI sukuk, have been developed, which are designed to raise money to fund socially beneficial projects for everybody. Take, for example, Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, which launched the first international sukuk intended for a charitable purpose in 2014, raising $500 million in its first year to help fund immunization programs in some of the world's poorest countries. I am delighted also to note that Khazanah Sukuk is an example of an SRI Sukuk, which helps to fund schools and education right here in Malaysia. I sincerely hope that more Sukuk may be used to such socially responsible ends in the future, and that as Sukuk issuance continues to increase, spreading to new markets such as the United Kingdom and South Africa, it seems that this hope could very well be realized. Sukuk bonds are emerging as a viable, popular, and ethical investment option, and this is a contribution which Islam can make to the future of the economy and to human welfare on a truly global scale. This discussion of sukuk leads me into another area in which I believe Islam has an important role to play in securing the future of the planet, and that is of protecting and preserving the natural environment. As well as SRI sukuk bonds, recent years have also witnessed the inception of the so-called green sukuk, And I am very pleased to be able to say that Malaysia has been an innovator promoting bid'ah hasanah in this respect. Just last year in 2017, Malaysia launched the world's first ever green sukuk as a collaboration between the Central Bank and the Securities Commission together with the World Bank. The proceeds from this sukuk will finance environmentally beneficial projects such as the development of renewable energy sources here in Malaysia. But there is much more still to be done when it comes to tackling the ever-growing problem of climate change. This conforms to Islam's philosophy of the Adamic man's mandate as God's Khalifa to act as stewards of the planet. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala reminds us of our God-given honor in the Quran with the words, and I quote, "We appointed you as stewards in the earth so that we might see how you behave," unquote. With this God-given honor, we are entrusted also with a grave responsibility. At present, humanity is damaging, not nurturing the planet. And this ultimately means damaging the future. Carbon dioxide pollution, generated particularly by the burning of fossil fuels, has resulted in rapidly rising global temperatures, leading to the melting of glaciers and ice caps, and to dramatic rises in sea levels. To give a tangible sense of the rate at which this crisis is happening, researchers predict that most central and eastern Himalayan glaciers will have entirely disappeared by 2035. This is a stark indication of the speed with which we must act if we are to address the escalating problem of global warming. Climate change and human activities such as deforestation are also having a devastating effect on the Earth's biodiversity, leading to the extinction of the other living creatures with which we share this planet. According to the World Wildlife Fund, the rate of species extinction is somewhere between 1,000 and 10,000 times higher than the natural extinction rate. The preventable loss of a species is truly a loss for our future. It is a God-given duty of Muslims to strive to reverse, or at the very least, to halt this environmental damage. The future of the planet is our divine responsibility. When I say that the future is ours, however, I do not speak only as a Muslim. I speak also as a human, as a citizen of the world, as belonging to that Adamic family. For I believe that the future belongs to each and every one of us, irrespective of our religion, our race, and even our nationality. Indeed, if we are to take on the major challenges like climate change, which pose a serious and imminent threat to our future, we must think and work beyond our modern borders and identity boundaries And we must also, moreover, empower each and every individual to feel that their actions can make a difference. The former First Lady of the United States of America, Eleanor Roosevelt, once wrote in an inspirational phrase, and I quote, that the future belongs to those who believe in the beauty of their dreams, unquote. And although it might sound like something of a cliche, it is a notion that I would like all of us to hold on to today. The future belongs to those who believe that they have the power to shape it, to effect real, decisive change, and to have their voices heard. We have just witnessed our 14th general election 2 months ago here, where the citizens of Malaysia, the voters, brought about substantial, even unprecedented political transformation through the ballot box. From this defining moment in our country's relatively young history, I do hope that the citizens of Malaysia feel empowered to make their mark and to influence their nation's future. As I stressed a little over a decade ago, Malaysians of all races, religions, and geographic location need to believe beyond a shadow of a doubt that they have a place under the Malaysian sun. It will require what our ulama call both tashdeed as well as islah to breathe new life into and to rejuvenate our institutions and, where necessary, to improve upon them. There is no denying, however, that there will be growing pains in our journey to make Malaysia a mature democracy, to join the rest of the community of nations already in their premier league of democracy, so to speak. That is why I believe that we should not leave anyone behind in this process, including those with whom we may disagree. We must avoid the unhealthy practice made in some countries where, following an important victory, the winner takes all. Everyone under the Malaysian sun should be a part of this journey, and we should be mindful to involve all of the nation's stakeholders in this historic journey. I have spoken at this conference several times in the past about the vital importance of investing in and empowering the world's youth. Young people, after all, really do represent our planet's future. To reiterate a hugely pertinent quotation, which I cited 2 years ago, by the director of the United Nations Population Fund, and I quote, "Young people are the innovators, creators, builders, and leaders of the future. But they can transform the future only if they have skills, health, decision making, and real choices in life," unquote. Of course, investment in education and healthcare is absolutely vital. But it is this notion of involving young people in decision making and empowering them to feel that they do have real choices in life, which I wish to dwell on before closing. We often talk about young people being the leaders and policy makers of tomorrow. But I suggest that we also need to do more to make young people feel actively consulted and engaged in decision making today. Indeed, there are numerous case studies which demonstrate that mobilizing youth populations, for example, in national peace building and community cohesion projects can be hugely effective, significantly improving the overall success of such efforts. Following the end of the Nepalese Civil War, a little over a decade ago, the thorough involvement of young people in peace consultations resulted in an 80% reduction in violent protests. Meanwhile, earlier this year, UNESCO reaffirmed its commitment to continue and to reinforce its work with young people in community development in South Sudan, ensuring, and I quote, that their voices are not only heard, but that they actually become drivers of change in their respective communities, unquote. At the same time, there is also evidence to suggest that when young people feel disempowered, disaffected, and ignored, they will inevitably seek to bring about change in other less constructive, collaborative, democratic, and even peaceful ways. Analysis of the Arab Spring of 2011 has suggested that youth unemployment was one of the underlying causes of the uprising. With unemployment rate at almost 30% in Tunisia, where the protests began. Notably, reports indicate that jobs were high on the demand lists of these early protesters. What is especially tragic about this fact is that despite youth unemployment being a root cause and driver of the uprising, very little has changed in the aftermath of these events in the Arab world. World Bank statistics indicate that youth unemployment rates are actually even higher now than they were in 2011. The message, it seems, is only too clear. When young people are consulted and actively involved in political and diplomatic processes, they can help to effect change, which is significant, peaceful, and positive for all. When young people feel overlooked and disenfranchised, the routes they may take in their attempts to get their voices heard can actually result in a worsening of their already compromised situation. In Malaysia, it would seem, but also around the world, we need to do more to enable young people to become drivers of change, to empower them to believe that the future really is theirs to influence and build. As leaders, scholars, and people with a platform, we need not only to champion those issues which we believe matter to today's youth, but also to invite young people to speak and to be heard to share their ideas in their own words within democratic and diplomatic forums and not outside of them. To underline the vital importance of this, I emphasize that young people currently make up nearly half of the world's population. As of 2017, 42% of the global population was under the age of 25, and that number is set to increase. We must, I think, do more to engage these many millions of people in shaping their tomorrow, today. Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, my thoughts today have not shied away, I hope, from the many difficult challenges facing our world in the future. Youth disempowerment, financial uncertainty, political turmoil, global warming, these are just some of the serious issues that we must address, and quickly indeed, if our world is to have a future at all. But my message is ultimately, I hope, one of optimism. It will undoubtedly take the efforts of us all, young and old, men and women, of every faith, nationality, race and creed, to secure our planet's future. The future is our collective responsibility, and if we take up that responsibility now, the future will also, I believe, be our reward in this life and inshallah in the next. Thank you.